Tracy McCauley.
I'm Nathan Wayne.
And I'm Liz Wong.
We are cardiology pharmacists, educators, and self-declared literature crusaders.
And welcome to CardioScripts, a cardiology podcast brought to you in collaboration with the ACCP Cardiology Practice and Research Network.
Today on CardioScripts, we are so lucky to have a repeat guest on today. Dr. Tom Yerga is a clinical pharmacy specialist in the outpatient cardiology clinic at the Lieutenant Colonel Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He graduated from the Chicago State University College of Pharmacy and then went on to complete a PGY-1 pharmacy practice at the John H. Stroger Jr. Hospital of Cook County in Chicago, where he focused on his clinical experience and research on pharmacist involvement in AM care, diabetes management, and cardiovascular disease treatment. After graduating residency, he accepted a faculty role at Roosevelt University College of Pharmacy with a clinical practice site at the Cardiology and Diabetes Clinic at Mount Sinai Hospital in Chicago. He holds pharmacy board certifications in pharmacotherapy, ambulatory care, and cardiology. He is a certified diabetes care and education specialist, and he recently received the honor of becoming an associate of the American College of Cardiology. His passion for cardiology led him to his current position at the VA in Ann Arbor, where he is responsible for managing a spectrum of cardiac disorders, such as optimizing heart failure regimens, which is his main area of focus. He serves as a subject matter expert to the VA Academic Detailing Service, and also serves as a preceptor to the VA PGY-1 pharmacy residents and in partnership with the University of Michigan to PGY-2 cardiology residents. Tom, welcome back to CardioScripts.
It's so nice to be back. Thanks for bringing me back here.
So today we're going to be talking to Tom about the CLEAR Outcomes trial that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine. And the purpose was to evaluate bempedoic acid and its impact on cardiovascular events. So we'll walk through the CLEAR Outcomes trial, and then we'll get Tom's thoughts on everything lipids. So in the CLEAR Outcomes trial, they included patients who were 18 to 85 years and were either classified as primary or secondary prevention patients. If they were unable or unwilling to receive a statin due to adverse drug events that started on statin therapy and resolved or improved upon statin discontinuation. They also included patients and providers if they acknowledge that they are aware of the statin benefits and that many patients can receive a different statin or statin dose if unable to tolerate the initial statin regimen. Patients could be on a very low statin dose, which they defined in their appendix, and the fasting LDL needed to be 100 milligrams per deciliter or greater at the first visit while on stable LDL-C lowering therapies. They excluded patients who had triglycerides greater than 500 milligrams per deciliter, renal dysfunction, A1C of 10% or higher, or a recent acute cardiovascular disease event. This was a double-blind, randomized, multi-center, placebo-controlled study. There was a four-week run-in period where patients received single-blind placebo, and they were randomized in a one-to-one ratio to bempedoic acid 180 milligrams daily versus placebo. In terms of the endpoints, from an efficacy standpoint, they were looking at a composite of cardiovascular disease, non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke, or coronary revascularization. From a safety standpoint, they were looking at an adverse event that started or worsened after the first dose of a trial agent, adverse events leading to discontinuation of the trial regimen. They looked at hepatic enzyme levels, renal impairment, as well as changes in uric acid levels. So in terms of results, the patients that were ultimately included had a mean age of 65 years. About half of the patients were female. The majority were white, about 91%. The mean baseline LDL was 139 milligrams per deciliter, HDL about 49, total cholesterol 223. And about 30% of patients included were classified as primary prevention patients and 70% secondary prevention patients. And about 50% of those in the secondary prevention class had coronary artery disease. About 45% of patients included had diabetes. Roughly 22 to 23% were on a statin, and about 12% were on ezetimibe. So when looking at LDL-C, the mean LDL at 6 months was 107. Versus 136 in the bempedoic acid and placebo groups, respectively. So there was a 21.1% reduction in LDL favoring bempedoic acid. In terms of high sensitivity CRP levels, That decreased by 21.6% at 6 months in favor of the bempedoic acid group. And then in terms of efficacy, so that composite endpoint, it occurred in 11.7% of patients in the bempedoic acid group versus 13.3% of patients in the placebo group. The hazard ratio was 0.87, and the 95% confidence interval was 0.79 to 0.96. This came out to a number needed to treat of 63. And the difference that was found was driven by fatal or non-fatal MI. It occurred in 3.7% of those in the bempedoic acid group versus 4.8% of those in the placebo group. And the hazard ratio was 0.77, 95% confidence interval, 0.66 to 0.91. And it was also driven by a difference in coronary revascularization events between the two groups. Events occurred 6.2% versus 7.6% in the bempedoic acid and placebo groups, respectively. Hazard ratio was 0.81. The 95% confidence interval was 0.72 to 0.92. And then in terms of safety endpoints, some notable items to include that there was an increase in renal impairment with bempedoic acid. This occurred in the bempedoic acid group 11.5% versus 8.6% in the placebo group. There were elevated hepatic enzymes that were levels that were also noted in the bempedoic acid group compared to placebo, 4.5% versus 3%. Hyperuricemia as well in the bempedoic acid group, 10.9% versus 5.6%. Gout occurred more frequently as well in the bempedoic acid group, as well as cholelithiasis. Additionally, in terms of the change in uric acid level, it increased by 0.76 milligrams per deciliter in the bempedoic acid group and decreased by 0.03, almost neutral, milligrams per deciliter in the placebo group. So that is a brief overview of the CLEAR Outcomes trial. And there's a little bit to unpack here, but before we jump into that, Tom, could we take a 3,000-point view and talk about what bempedoic acid is? If you can talk a little bit about how it works and just things to watch out for if a patient is put on it.
Yeah, I think it's a great point to kind of go back and talk about the drug itself, because I find that a lot of people that I speak with are still a little confused about like what exactly is bempedoic acid. A lot of our providers are still a little lost about like what this entity even is. So it is a small molecule drug. It has a very simple oral dose of 180 milligrams once a day. According to the package label, there's not a whole lot of renal or hepatic dose adjustments that we need to worry about. But I do want to point out that it wasn't studied in patients with end-stage renal disease or severe hepatic impairment, so we got to be mindful of that. What it does is it inhibits the action of adenosine triphosphate, or ATP citrate lyase, so ATP citrate lyase, which then prevents the formation of acetyl-CoA. So if we think back to our cholesterol synthesis pathway, this is way upstream from where statins end up inhibiting HMG-CoA reductase, which that translates to, for us in the clinical world, are a few downstream effects. So of course, the first effect is it lowers LDL. It lowers LDL production by about 20-25%, which we will get into based on the CLEAR studies. But there's also some side effects that leads to. And one of those side effects is the thing that we saw in CLEAR Outcomes, as you talked about, which is hyperuricemia. Also, that leads to a small amount of gout episodes in patients. But we should remember that most of the gout episodes that we observe with this trial are in patients with pre-existing gout rather than new patients being diagnosed with new gout. So the other thing that we really should mention with bempedoic acid is this warning about tendon rupture. So none of the CLEAR trials individually that we'll go over later mention tendon rupture as a side effect or as a relevant side effect, but the FDA did issue that warning about tendon ruptures based on earlier bempedoic acid studies. So there was a pooled analysis of the four CLEAR trials. Out of the 2,400 patients on bempedoic acid, only 6 had tendon ruptures, but none in the 1,200 placebo patients developed tendon ruptures. So there's definitely something to consider. if someone does develop tendon rupture while receiving bempedoic acid, discontinue the drug. It's best if we avoid it in patients who have a previous history of tendon ruptures, and then just be cautious, be mindful of risk factors for tendon rupture, like those patients who might be receiving corticosteroids or fluoroquinolones, or those with kidney failure, or especially those who are older than 60 years of age. So that's on the side effects. And then you mentioned a few other side effects that might happen in the clinical trials that we observed, but really tendon ruptures and that hyperuricemia and gout are the big ones that we should be mindful of. The nice thing about bempedoic acid is that it has very few drug interactions. The most important things that we have to remember is that, so it can be obviously combined with a statin, but it should be avoided when using doses of simvastatin above 20 milligrams daily or pravastatin above 40 milligrams daily, because it can double the serum concentrations of those two particular statins. But otherwise, bempedoic acid is very well tolerated besides the hyperuricemia. It has a convenient dosing schedule, and it does lower the LDL.
Awesome. Thank you, Tom. And another question before jumping into the trial. Where are we at with management of dyslipidemia and ASCVD risk reduction currently? And then if you could just layer in, where does bempedoic acid fit in?
Oh, man, this is a discussion for an episode in itself, isn't it? I think we're still trying to sort out exactly how this drug fits in into our repertoire. So just to kind of go back. Up until now, we've been relying on the 2018 guidelines on dyslipidemia, which at the time, of course, didn't even mention bempedoic acid. Then we had our 2022 expert consensus on the role of non-statin therapies, which did end up mentioning bempedoic acid, but basically as a last-line therapy alongside things like inclisiran. So those were recommendations for patients with baseline ASCVD or hypercholesterolemia whose LDL was still above target despite maximal statin, ezetimibe, and a PCSK9 monoclonal antibody. So then, just a few weeks ago, we got the highly anticipated 2023 chronic coronary disease guidelines. And they basically reiterate the same thing. Similar concept. Patients who are on max tolerated doses of statins with ezetimibe, with a PCSK9 monoclonal antibody who fail to achieve an LDL cholesterol level of less than 70 may be considered for a bempedoic acid or for inclisiran. It's in the same recommendation. And then just to point out, inclisiran should be replacing an existing PCSK9 monoclonal antibody. So this bempedoic acid and inclisiran recommendation is a 2B recommendation in the guidelines. So it is a weak recommendation. So basically, we're considering this drug as a last line option for patients who fail to meet lipid goals. So the approach to hypercholesterolemia and ASCVD is sort of similar. So where do we land in terms of other patients? So maybe those who fall into those other statin benefit groups, like those with diabetes, but without ASCVD or hypercholesterolemia, or those with an elevated ASCVD risk score, but obviously without ASCVD or diabetes or hypercholesterolemia. Where do they fit in with bempedoic acid? So on that point, the 2022 expert consensus on non-statin use does not make a recommendation for bempedoic acid outside of ASCVD or those with familial hypercholesterolemia. Those with type 2 diabetes or an increased 10-year risk score, just simply based on our understanding from the guidelines, are not great candidates for bempedoic acid. Although the one point that is made is that in those patients who cannot tolerate statins, and this is kind of like what we're going into with the CLEAR Outcomes trial, is that in those patients, bempedoic acid may be a option, but again, a last line option. And then for those patients who do not have diabetes, who have a very low ASCVD risk score, so like below 20%, basically, they don't even make a recommendation for non-statin therapy. It's basically just statin or nothing. So I think it's also going to be important to point out a few elephants in the room while we're talking about ASCVD risk reduction and dyslipidemia, and that's the other agents that we sometimes fail to recall or maybe even use. There's still bile acid sequestrants, there's still fish oils, there's still fibrates, there's still niacin. However, maybe we're starting with niacin. In my opinion, it's getting phased out of practice. There's a lot of toxicities. It has a very minimal effect on lipid lowering. There's no net cardiovascular benefit with niacin. So pretty sure at this point, most of us are not considering niacin for our patients. It is still available over the counter in a lot of different preparations. So we got to be mindful of that and we got to stay vigilant because a lot of patients may be taking it. Bile acid sequestrants are interesting because they do have a place in therapy for patients with high cholesterol and diabetes. But again, those bile acid sequestrants also do not have any strong net cardiovascular benefits attributed to them. And then we, of course, have to be careful with using them in patients who have high triglycerides. And then they have tons of GI side effects and you have to separate medicines from them. So they're very cumbersome. But nonetheless, a cheap option for those who can't afford some of the more expensive medications. And then on the topic of reducing ASCVD risk, fibrates, fish oils, again, those exist. So when we're thinking about reducing ASCVD risk in our patients, there is the formulation of pure fish oil, icosapent ethyl, that's marketed as Vascepa, that continues to be controversial until this day in reducing ASCVD risk in patients who have a high triglyceride level. But then fibrates like pemafibrate in the PROMINENT trial failed to show any benefits. So just things to consider when we're thinking about addressing lipid levels and reducing ASCVD.
So Tom, could you give us a brief overview? You've alluded to these trials a couple of times, but some of the previous CLEAR trials that had come out prior to CLEAR Outcomes. And could you talk a little bit about the LDL reduction that was found?
Absolutely. So CLEAR Outcomes now is the fifth randomized controlled trial in the published CLEAR sequence. So it follows the awesomely named CLEAR Tranquility, Serenity, CLEAR Harmony, and CLEAR Wisdom. So let's start maybe with Tranquility, which was published in 2018, and then Serenity, which was published in 2019. So both of those trials were studied patients who were at baseline statin intolerant, so very similar to our CLEAR Outcomes, but they needed additional lipid-lowering therapy. In the case of Tranquility, patients were started on ezetimibe, and then were randomized to either receive placebo or bempedoic acid. So basically, we can thank Tranquility for the combination pill bempedoic acid ezetimibe that's currently marketed as Nexlizet. So then in Serenity, patients were receiving any lipid-lowering therapy. Ezetimibe happens to be the most common non-statin used. However, about only 60% of the patients in Serenity were on no lipid-lowering therapy at all. Both the Serenity and Tranquility trials included a primary endpoint that was the percent change from baseline to week 12 in LDL cholesterol. In Tranquility, after 12 weeks of bempedoic acid plus ezetimibe, compared to placebo, there was a 28.5% decrease from a baseline of 129 milligrams per deciliter on the LDL. In Serenity, that difference was about 21% from a higher baseline of about 158-ish. So actually a pretty high baseline in Serenity. So, okay, those were the two trials that looked at patients who were statin intolerant. So now CLEAR Harmony and CLEAR Wisdom, how does that fit in? These trials looked at patients with atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, heterozygous familial hypercholesterolemia, or both, and specifically with a minimum LDL of 70, regardless of the baseline indication. So in both cases, in Wisdom and Harmony, patients were on maximally tolerated statins. So given those inclusion criteria, what were the differences between Harmony and Wisdom? Well, Harmony was purely powered for safety of bempedoic acid, and then Wisdom, similar to Tranquility and Serenity, was designed to test the percent change in LDL over 12 weeks. So even though Harmony wasn't designed to test for this, it did find about an 18% drop in LDL at 12 weeks from a baseline of 103. So compared to the other studies, pretty low. And then Clear Wisdom saw about a 17% drop in LDL compared to placebo at 12 weeks from a baseline of about 120. So where does that leave us? So interestingly, in the Clear Wisdom trial, there were patients who are not on statin therapy at all. And in those patients not on statins, that LDL drop was 22%. So this sort of shows us that bempedoic acid is able to reduce LDL more when there is no statin on board. But when there is another lipid-lowering agent that's not a statin, like ezetimibe, you see more of a synergistic effect. So this kind of tells us that when added to a statin, that reduction is going to be less because those two drugs work on the same pathway. But when you add it to something like ezetimibe, it's a synergistic effect. So you actually end up with a slightly higher LDL reduction.
Awesome. Thanks, Tom, for walking us through that. I think that brings us to Clear Outcomes. So we had data in terms of LDL reduction up until this point, some safety as well. But the big question with bempedoic acid was, what about the cardiovascular outcomes with this drug? So could you give us your overall thoughts about the CLEAR Outcomes trial?
Oh, definitely. And I think we're going to dive a lot more deeper into the sub-analyses because those are really representative of how important it is to really look at the nitty-gritty facts of each trial. So let's start off by saying that CLEAR Outcomes was well-designed, was very well-balanced. You actually saw that it was pretty well-represented in terms of males and females. It was very well-balanced, probably more than most other ASCVD trials. So as you mentioned, we saw that bempedoic acid didn't just reduce LDL by about 21%, high sensitivity CRP by also about 21%. We saw this overall MACE reduction. However, there was no mortality reduction in patients who were intolerant to statins. While in similar trials on statins, we do see signals for more benefits, especially in the VA trials. We see that even in some primary prevention trials, we see some mortality benefits with statins, but those are smaller trials, probably more hypothesis generating than anything. So when we're thinking about CLEAR Outcomes as a trial, when we think about the biggest limitation of this study is the fact that it just simply studied statin intolerant patients. I mean, the authors say so themselves. The fact that these patients were statin intolerant and were not on statin resulted in a pretty high baseline LDL. So on average, about 140 milligrams per deciliter. That's a high baseline LDL. When we compare that to the PCSK9 monoclonal antibody trials and to the IMPROVE-IT trial with ezetimibe, their mean baseline LDLs were in the mid-90s. So we're already off to a shaky start when comparing these agents. So basically, it's comparing apples to oranges in terms of outcomes. So when we're thinking about how these investigators included patients into the trial, patients had to fail two or more statins at any dose or just fail one statin at any dose and then be unwilling to try a second statin, which is extremely lax because we typically try at least three statins, at least in my practice, before we forsake statins altogether. And at least one of them has to be at the lowest possible dose. So that was a clear limitation in my eyes, just forsaking statin therapy. But obviously, the trial had to happen. It's important to point out that a fifth of these patients were on some statin therapy because, as defined by the investigators, patients who were tolerating very low doses of statin therapies could continue them throughout the duration of the trial. So that was defined as something like a daily average of rosuvastatin less than 5 milligrams or less than 10 milligrams for atorvastatin. And then overall, bempedoic acid was well tolerated. I think the discontinuation rate was just about 10%, which was very similar to placebo. And then when we really get into the side effect profile, was fairly well tolerated overall. So now when we really look at what the trial found in terms of sub-analyses, one of the things to consider in addition to the high LDL was that at baseline, these patients also had elevated high sensitivity CRP. We know that bempedoic acid reduces both LDL and CRP. We know that high sensitivity CRP of 2 or greater is considered a risk enhancer for cardiovascular disease. And these patients at baseline were at a mean of 2.3. So given the high baseline LDL and high sensitivity CRP, I'm not all too surprised that there were some benefits observed because we were treating these patients with something as against nothing in the placebo group. So we know that the LDL can be reduced by about 20-25% with bempedoic acid and high sensitivity CRP by about 20%. However, when we look at the subgroup analyses, we find that the benefit, the MACE benefit of bempedoic acid is lost if your baseline CRP is less than 2 and if your LDL is less than 130. And then because bempedoic acid reduces LDL by only about 20-25%, you see that the benefit is also lost in patients with an LDL of above 160. So again, this is a subgroup analysis, but something to consider when we're thinking about this drug. The most surprising finding, in my opinion, in this trial was the sub-analysis showing that there was a MACE outcome reduction, so a major adverse cardiac event reduction, not in the secondary prevention group, but in the primary prevention group. So we saw this in the forest plot, but I think this is our opportunity to dig a little bit deeper into the weeds about this. There was recently a separately published sub-analysis of the CLEAR Outcomes trial of the primary prevention group. And the most interesting thing about that sub-analysis is that they were actually able to find a reduction in all-cause mortality in addition to the MACE outcomes when they compared bempedoic acid to placebo. So the event rates for all-cause mortality were about 3.5, about 3.6% in the bempedoic acid group compared to 5.2% in placebo, with a number needed to treat of 63, funny enough, similar to the MACE outcomes and CLEAR outcomes. Very important things to remember about what I just said, though. This is a sub-analysis of a subpopulation of a larger trial. So this isn't exactly designed for making clear decisions. This could possibly be explained by a type 1 error or a false positive. So one of the things that you also should consider when you're really thinking about these findings is if there was a benefit that was observed in CLEAR outcomes and in the subsequent analysis, it's important to think about the attenuation effect of an otherwise more aggressive lipid lowering regimen. So those patients who required secondary prevention and CLEAR outcomes tended to be on more aggressive lipid lowering therapy. Those were the patients who were more likely to be on that low dose statin and were more likely to be on ezetimibe, which again may have attenuated the benefit of bempedoic acid. So it's important to point out that the authors themselves mentioned this as hypothesis generating, and I think we need at least a few more studies on this before we make any clear decisions in the primary prevention group.
Yeah, thanks, Tom, for walking through that. I'll say for me, I wanted bempedoic acid to just show this clear mortality benefit. That was what I was really hoping to see in CLEAR outcomes. But I think for a lot of what you pointed out, especially with that LDL hanging out at 130, 140 at baseline, kind of puts questions in my mind in terms of like, where does bempedoic acid fit within the whole scheme? You mentioned only a fifth of patients were on the very low dose statin, only about 12% were on ezetimibe, and then we don't have PCSK9 inhibitors. So all interesting points. And there was a lot of discussion about those points as well, like on Twitter or X or what have you, when this came out back in March of 2023. So jumping into the next question, in your mind, which populations would benefit from bempedoic acid? And maybe I kind of jump into this question already, I'm sorry, but how would you approach choosing bempedoic acid over other non-statins or not?
Right. So thinking about the right phenotype is definitely crucial. So, okay, based on the 2022 expert consensus and the 2023 chronic coronary guidelines, if we were to simply answer this question, this is a last line drug that's added on to max statin, ezetimibe, PCSK9 inhibitor. However, now we have a little bit more light shown on this. I also would have liked if there was a mortality benefit, because we would have had something that's similar to a statin, but not a statin. Because the way I was always thinking about bempedoic acid is that it's basically like a lower intensity statin, right? Because it's in the same pathway and it does reduce LDL like a low intensity statin. So some things to, I guess, remember from the CLEAR Outcomes trial when we're thinking about the right patient phenotype, when we're considering bempedoic acid for somebody. One of the things that bempedoic acid did is it also reduced HDL by about 3 to 4%. And then when we're looking at the CLEAR studies, those patients in those studies actually had a pretty high baseline of HDL. And CLEAR Outcomes, it was almost about 50. I don't know about you, but most of my patients have HDLs in the 30s. So they actually have way lower HDLs than in the CLEAR trials. So we have to be very mindful of that when we're starting this therapy. We can't lose that additional protective factor of a high HDL when we're choosing this drug. The other thing to remember when we're thinking about the right patient is that bempedoic acid elicited the strongest benefits in patients with already baseline elevated risks, like those with diabetes, right? Thinking back to that sub-analysis where a lot of patients in the primary prevention cohort had diabetes, and those with high markers of inflammation, so those with high sensitivity CRPs above 2, and then the baseline LDL above 130. Anything other than that seems that the effect was dulled. And then how does it compare to other non-statins like PCSK9, monoclonal antibodies, in terms of reducing those risk factors? So bempedoic acid reduces high sensitivity CRP, while PCSK9 monoclonal antibodies do not. Bempedoic acid has no effect on lipoprotein A, while PCSK9 monoclonal antibodies do. And then PCSK9 mAbs also reduce LDL basically twice as much as bempedoic acid. So at this point, I think we're starting to form this patient phenotype that could potentially benefit most from bempedoic acid while having that reduction in cardiovascular outcomes, and potentially maybe even benefit on a cost effectiveness scale. Cost really does have to come in mind, because it is a new drug. It is expensive. I think the most recent out-of-pocket cost for bempedoic acid was about $400 a month. And as of right now, insurance companies are not quick to cover it, but PCSK9 mAbs are equally as pricey, if not more, but insurance companies are more likely to cover them. So there haven't been any cost analyses published since CLEAR Outcomes, but there was a cost effectiveness analysis done on patients with high cardiovascular risk who were on statins, ezetimibe, and PCSK9 mAbs. And that cost analysis did not find bempedoic acid cost effective. But again, that was before CLEAR Outcomes was published, before this secondary analysis was published. So we just got to wait for more information on costs to come out.
So Tom, can you discuss your approach to managing statin intolerance?
Oh man, this is probably the most individualized aspect of how I run each clinical visit with patients. Because in my role, I typically inherit patients with statin intolerance rather than getting return patients complaining of statin intolerances after I start a statin. In my mind, the most important way to manage statin intolerance is to be proactive and be very open about statin treatment before you even begin the treatment itself. That's kind of how I approach the situation with my patients. I go over evidence for statin benefits. I go over evidence for possibilities of side effects. I mentioned the results of the Samson trial. So to recall, in Samson, the way they randomized patients was to either nothing, placebo, or a statin, and everything was blinded. So thanks to the Samson trial, we were able to see that about 90% of statin intolerance can be attributed to this nocebo effect. Basically, if you expect a bad outcome, it may happen. So there's a lot of pre-education that goes into this. So I mentioned these things to my patients. I mentioned these things during my cardiac rehabilitation classes when I teach about statins and other drugs. And I'm very open and frank about the benefits, the possibilities for risk to happen. So, okay, then how do I actually manage existing statin intolerance? I like to ask a patient about the nature and quality of their pain. How long has it been going on? Where is it located? Does it go away? Does it get worse with anything? Most patients complain of muscle-related symptoms, so that's usually what I just focus on. There's also a great tool for assessing statin intolerance on the American College of Cardiology website. So you can always use that if you have time, of course. Normally, what we'll do is we'll try going off of statin for about 2 weeks. Then if the pain goes away, then we know that the statin may have contributed to the pain. So we'll talk about possibly retrialing something else, some other statin. Now, if the pain does not go away, we clearly know or we can suspect that it wasn't a statin. And we try to reintroduce it, explaining that there might be other factors that we have to consider. And of course, this has to be a conversation with the patient, like what else is causing them to be in pain. We have to obviously help them come to more controlled pain status. Some sources also say that you can pause a statin for up to 6 weeks and that's safe. So if you want a longer trial, that's possible. So, okay, if the pain does go away and we are considering restarting statin therapy, we will usually decide on starting a different statin at a lower dose. However, it's also appropriate to consider the same statin, but at a lower dose. In my practice, we typically end up going away from a high-intensity atorvastatin and starting with a low-intensity rosuvastatin. And then going from there. I have patients on low doses like 2.5 milligrams every other day. But the important thing is that we have to follow up with these patients so that they're not stuck on those lowest possible doses, because chances are they might end up tolerating a higher dose. If my patients cannot tolerate a high or moderate intensity statin, then chances are they won't get to their lipid goals, which then pushes me to seek other non-statin therapies. And then most of the time, I land on a PCSK9 monoclonal antibody because it is available to us and it does help reduce LDL to a much greater degree rather than starting them on ezetimibe.
And Tom, what is your overall pharmacologic approach to reduce ASCVD?
Before I talk about the pharmacologic approach, let me just give a plug for my non-pharmacological approach. It's important to discuss diet, exercise, and getting your updated vaccines. That is very crucial. So if you have the ability, please involve a dietitian, send your patients to cardiac rehab, and then make sure their vaccines are up to date. That's it for my non-pharmacological approach. I just have to give that plug as somebody who also obviously recognizes the benefits of non-pharmacological treatments of ASCVD. But okay, what do we do with the pharmacological approach? I think this definitely does depend on who is sitting in front of me, right? Because we can be talking about really a multifaceted approach at looking at the patient. We can't just look at their LDL-C levels anymore. I think it's clear. LDL-C is a driving force for worsening ASCVD, but there is a multitude of other risk factors that we have to consider. So this is something that the JUPITER trial with rosuvastatin kind of showed us. And now the CLEAR studies, those inflammatory risks can also increase future ASCVD risk. I haven't even mentioned the Lodoco trials with colchicine, but we know that there is a benefit in reducing those inflammatory markers, such as through reducing high sensitivity CRP. Although it is important to mention that earlier trials on just purely reducing high sensitivity CRP did not seem very beneficial, but now that we have these drugs like bempedoic acid that kind of do many things at once, and then of course statins, that's kind of a different story. So that's something that we have to really consider. So those inflammatory risks are there. Then there's the thrombotic risks that we have to consider when we're talking to our patients. This is more relevant in the more acute phase of treatment, and that's typically more driven by the complexity of one's PCI, more so than the residual risk of anything else. So then there's other things like hypertriglyceridemia, elevated LP little a, and then, of course, diabetes. What's their diabetes status? Is it controlled? Is it uncontrolled? Is it type 1, type 2 diabetes? A lot of patients will have overlapping risk factors, and many will require a multi-specialty approach. So like in the cases of diabetes management, we'll have to get a diabetes specialist on board. And then there's been recently published evidence of pitavastatin having a benefit in HIV patients. And then there's a CLEAR HIV trial underway. So there's definitely a lot of things that we have to consider when we're thinking about the pharmacological approach to reducing ASCVD. When it comes to just following this simple algorithm of just targeting LDL, we have a pretty clear picture of what is the best possible approach for our patients. Get them to an LDL goal of less than 70 with a max tolerated statin. If you can't get them there with a statin, throw in ezetimibe. I personally like the approach of using the 25% or greater rule. So if they require an additional 25% reduction in LDL, then I'll consider a PCSK9 monoclonal antibody first. I will point out that the guidelines say that this is of low economic value, but because where I practice at the VA system, it is possible for me to have that approach. For others, it might not be possible. Also, at the same time, the prices of PCSK9 mAbs have improved dramatically over the years, so it might be more cost effective. So those are some of the approaches that you can also think about.
Awesome, Tom. Well, thank you for walking through a ton of information in such a short period of time. So I guess just to wrap it up, like, what are your final thoughts about the CLEAR Outcomes trial? Any key takeaways for our audience?
Of course. You know what? This was not supposed to be such a beast of a topic, but because of all these quirky findings and the sub-analysis, this grew to be a much bigger problem that we really had to dissect. My final thoughts, statins are the main cornerstone of lipid-lowering therapy. That goes without saying. And honestly, these trials kind of highlight that because of the LDL at baseline, because of the benefits that we see when we really lower all these other risk factors. So as for CLEAR Outcomes itself, I think this was an important trial. I think it was very important to see how modifying those ASCVD risk factors affected our patients. I really think that patients who are at that higher ASCVD risk, where statins would be cornerstones of therapy, but patients cannot tolerate them, I think bempedoic acid might be an option for them if the price is right and if they cannot tolerate other agents like ezetimibe and the PCSK9 monoclonal antibodies. I think that going forward, we will need more evidence and maybe a few more studies, really looking at that primary prevention cohort that then goes more ignored. There are some population-based studies that look at primary prevention globally, and we see that maybe only 50% of patients who could be on a statin are on a statin. So there's definitely a lot more work to do. CLEAR Outcomes kind of sheds the light on that, showing that a lot of patients need that additional lipid lowering, and we should really be addressing that cholesterol management and that those other risks when we're thinking about our patients.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. So I just want to thank you on behalf of Tracy, Nathan, and myself for joining us again at CardioScripts. Thank you.
It was such a pleasure to be back. Very passionate about talking about, you know, heart failure, lipid management, all the things cardiology. So this was great. Thank you so much for having me here again.
Thanks for tuning in to CardioScripts. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please tell your friends and subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at CardioScripts and check out our website at cardioscripts.com.
The views and opinions are those of the individuals on today's episode. The ACCP Cardiology PRN is not responsible for the presented content or its accuracy.